Genesis 2:15 says where Adam was placed in the garden to tend and keep it.
Yeah.
And I see tend and keep it as kind of my marching orders to a degree. I mean, because tending and keeping means that it's going to be there when I'm no longer able, but my children or grandchildren are there.
Welcome to the Unleashed Generosity podcast, exploring the intersection of faith, service, philanthropy, and community. I'm your host, Aaron Scott. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning in for episode 8. This is our third episode that's going to focus on the topics of eating, agriculture, the land, stewardship of place, those kind of things. Before we jump in and introduce this particular episode and our guest, though, I want to point you to where you can find us online, unleashgenerosity.org. You can also find all episodes of the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. You can also listen on our website to all past episodes. Find us on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter. If you have not already done so, I would love it if you would take just a few minutes to go to Apple Podcasts and rate the podcast or do a short review. This allows other people to find the podcast. My prediction in episode 1 that we would be more popular than Some Good News by episode 5 haven't quite gotten there. So any ways that you can help spread the word, I'd certainly appreciate you doing that. So jumping into today, third episode focusing on agriculture and on food. And in episode 6, we talked to Rhonda Chafin from Second Harvest Food Bank of Northeast Tennessee. In episode 7, we talked with Kathleen Terry Baker from Appalachian Sustainable Development. And then today, I'm pleased to be joined by Roy Settle of the Appalachian RC&D Council. So you might be wondering to yourself, why three separate episodes? So these three organizations are looking at these issues of sustainability and food and what we put into our bodies through three different lenses. We had Rhonda looking at things through food insecurity and how do we take care of our neighbors and make sure that there's not hunger. That sort of lens is a really important topic of conversation, and organizations out there doing that work is really important. Kathleen was talking more about working with farmers in terms of a grassroots sort of nonprofit perspective. How do you do economic development in rural areas? How do you help those farmers get things to market? And my conversation today with Roy, while Roy has some of the same sort of perspectives that Kathleen does, and while his organization has a similar sort of mission as Kathleen, he has really interesting perspectives as somebody who was a government employee and worked for USDA. And so he has sort of the macro level view of thinking about how policy and how the government's role in conservation and in stewardship and working with individuals can be an important piece to that puzzle. Doing this series on food and the land and thinking about the place where we live and our local communities very early in the podcast was important because for me, all that stuff is very foundational for how I think about everything we talk about on this podcast. In order to bring about change in an outward-facing sort of way, it really begins by addressing things internally and having an inward focus, dealing with things in your own body, in your own life, and then moving outward from there. Today, these terms are going to come up a lot. Stewardship, tending and keeping. We're going to talk some about the spiritual connections between the physical and the spiritual and how we take care of the land, take care of the food that goes into our bodies, how we take care of our community and our neighbors. And again, starting with the individual body and then working out from there, you really have this opportunity to think about things at the most basic level. If we're not taking care of the simple things at the most basic level, then it's easy to lose sight of those things as you get into the macro level. So I hope that these conversations have been interesting to you to learn a little bit more about food and agriculture and sustainability, but I also think maybe philosophically, it's a helpful lens through which to think about community development and to think about the nonprofit sector and to think about all of our ways in which we want to be a part of making the world a better place. This ethic of stewardship of the things that are most close to you. So with that introduction, let's jump into the conversation with Roy Settle from the Appalachian RC&D Council. All right. Well, welcome.
Hey, glad to be here.
So start by giving us a little bit of background about you, just whatever you want to tell us personally, professionally.
Sure. Roy Settle. Grew up in Clarksville, Tennessee, Middle Tennessee. Spent a lot of time, and I think at least what we're going to talk about, on both my grandparents' family farms as a child. Mm-hmm. You know, following in the footsteps of Curtis Settle and Douglas Mathis, trudging around and had adventures that my kids didn't get to have, but I wouldn't trade anything for them. You know, had cut some bit by a pig and a lot of different, you know, things happened during those times, but, you know, treasure that time. You know, grew up studying agriculture in high school and then got a degree in agriculture from Austin Peay State University there where I went to school. And during that time, while I was in college, I got a chance to be a trainee, student trainee with USDA with the Soil Conservation Service, which is now known as the Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS, mm-hmm. and did 3 summers in different parts of the state with that, and then was offered a job when I graduated and went to far northwest Tennessee, Union City, about as far as you can get from here.
Yeah.
Right there on the Missouri-Kentucky line, working in big agriculture, large, large farms, lots of corn, soybeans, you know, very large scale agriculture like you see more in the Midwest. Was there for 2.5 years and moved to a little bitty town in Middle Tennessee, was there for about a year, and then got promoted to come to Sullivan County in 88.
Okay.
And worked kind of that same job overseeing the conservation work for the agency in Sullivan County, you know, during that time. You know, that led to an opportunity to kind of to help start the USDA part of the Appalachian RC&D Council.
Okay.
RC&D was a federal program. You had to submit an application to the Secretary of Agriculture, get approved, and then, you know, some would get funded every year in a community. And mm-hmm. I'd work with the local county executives at that time, now county mayors. And we had a successful application and that created the job. And I was blessed and fortunate enough to get that job.
Okay.
And so that was my profession, working for USDA, but really working with a local board, really serving more like as a nonprofit executive director, and did mm-hmm. that from 94 until 2011 when it got cut nationwide from the federal budget, mm-hmm. and still had a job, but had an opportunity to do an early retirement, and had a bank that contacted me about doing agriculture lending, which is still in the field that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been doing that for 8.5 years now. So kind of backing up a little bit, married, we've got 2 sons. One is 28 in San Diego. He's a chef in a restaurant. And mm-hmm. I've got another son that's still in school here and working his way through getting a degree. And I really love the outdoors, natural resources, you know, spend a lot of time hiking, fishing, used to hunt, but don't really do that much anymore. But, uh-huh. you know, did a lot of mountain biking and now I've kind of found another thing that you and I both share is spend most of my, at least 4 to 5 mornings a week with a bunch of crazy guys out in the cold and dark through F3, Fitness, Fellowship, and Faith.
Yeah.
And that has become a big part of my life because I've got a good solid group of men that share, you know, joys. They've helped me through the loss of a brother, my mother going through a lot of health issues, and been able to be there for some guys going through some very tough times in their life too. So a great blessing there. So you ought to do a show on that too if you haven't already.
Yeah, I was just going to say. So for the audience, if I accidentally refer to Wilbur, that's not a different person. That's actually Roy's F3 name. Every F3 person that shows up to an F3 workout gets nicknamed or renamed. So my F3 name is Cold Call and he is Wilbur. So if we slip into calling each other by our F3 names, you'll know what was going on there. So F3 has been great for me too. And as a nonprofit organization, we could certainly talk a lot about the F3 Foundation in a separate episode. I found that to be a really meaningful, not just a way to be active and stay physically fit, but like you talked about, the relationships are really the most meaningful part.
Yeah, that's for sure. So that, we attend Colonial Heights Baptist Church, ran across that church the first week or two that I was here looking for an apartment. I just felt led to attend that church and have not felt led or called to go anywhere else. I'm rotating back on as a deacon, been active in that church, met my wife through that church, and got married there and everything, so dedicated kids there. So that's our that's our home just kind of just down the road.
Great. So back up, I'm sure you could tell lots of stories about growing up on the farm. What did you all do on your farm? What did you raise? And what are some of the formative experiences that you like think about a lot now?
I didn't grow up on a farm, but both grandparents had farms and grew up kind of in farm country. My parents didn't have a farm, so I want to qualify that. Father's father had the bigger farm, cattle, but also did a lot of feed, hay, and whatnot for those cows, raised corn for that, raised hogs, obviously, quite a few. Mm-hmm. My grandfather would raise enough potatoes for him, his, I guess, spinster sisters, and then all of his kids. So a large potato patch. I mean, we're talking a few acres.
Wow.
It was one of those things that while all the cousins would come in, all dozen of us would come in for picking, my dad was the only son, so it would be my father, grandfather, my brother and I, and the hired man to plant this acres of potatoes.
Wow.
So, and that was always, cold in the spring and everything. And it was something, that I would think about because we would have to cut up the potatoes. But I had a moment that just really got me a few years ago. Well, it's probably been 10 years or more ago. My sons and I were helping my father plant his potatoes, not near as many, mm-hmm. but my dad and I were on the two tractors that my father and grandfather would have been on when I was a kid. These same tractors were going back like 30 years.
Yeah.
And over on the tailgate of a truck, different truck, obviously, my two boys are doing what me and my brother were doing as preteens, early teens. And, I was just kind of overcome with, as I am right now, thinking about, wow, what are the odds that that would happen? And even though we're two generations removed, they're three generations kind of removed from growing up on a farm, but they're still getting to have some of those experiences. And, as a kid, didn't enjoy working in this huge garden that my parents had. But when I got my first place, once we kind of got in the house, the first thing I did was plant a garden.
Yeah.
And, that's a big part of what I do. I've got a hoe that was my grandfather. It's very special to me.
Yeah.
And I'm not kind of scratching around in the dirt. It's kind of my, I guess, refuge after a hard day in the world of banking or whatever is to kind of get out there and play in the dirt. Before my son moved to California, he got a job at a restaurant. They were just building a new Longhorn in Kingsport. And he started learning from this guy who was a senior partner and kind of took him under his wing. And before too long, they'd offered him a promotion to Les Knoxville to Turkey Creek to help set that one up.
Okay.
And started really getting into it. Before he went to California, he told me, we're sitting in the living room, and he said, Dad, I wished I had paid more attention to all the stuff you try to teach me about growing food in the land. And I'm thinking, wow, there's that kind of coming back around.
Yeah.
That love for the land, that stewardship that was built into us many, many, generations. And now he's very much into the farm to table movement, picks the restaurant that he works in, not because of the pay, but because of the opportunity to learn and grow and make sure that they're buying sustainably. And so he's become a young man that I'm very, very proud of.
Well, and I'm sure, proud of him for a lot of reasons, but just seeing that connection to your family history,
right,
and knowing that is a value that's living on in your kids.
Yeah, he knows he wants to leave California someday because he can't afford land, because he does want to have some land where he can grow his own food and for a restaurant at some point that hopefully he'll own.
Yeah.
But, he didn't want to get out and work in the garden any more than I did, but he learned to do it. And so you kind of get that dirt under your fingernails or whatever.
You said you didn't enjoy working in the garden like a lot of kids. That's something they have to do, not something
right.
They are super passionate about. But then you did choose to study agriculture. Kind of drew you to that.
Well, I started out working for farmers in hay and tobacco as a kid. Then my brother had gone to work at a large dairy farm and got me a job there about the time I started high school. And it was kind of a thing. I knew I was probably, I guess by that time I was already kind of interested. So I started taking FFA classes. As the more I got to work on that farm, learned and everything, worked for a very good boss. It was, always good to learn and teach and everything and not mm-hmm. yell at me too bad if I screwed up something.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of had that passion. So I worked in agriculture, since in all my life.
So yeah, you've thought about like our food systems through a number of different lenses.
Yes.
Which is kind of interesting because people that have farmed obviously have a lot of experience and have their own connections to the land.
Mm-hmm.
And like you use that term stewardship, kind of the stewardship of place and not just growing the food, but thinking about how do you take care of the land? How do you take care of the water? How do you make sure that it's something that's going to be there for the next generation? those are things that I'm sure a lot of farmers think about on their piece of land, but you've had different sort of jobs and roles that make you think about it differently and that you see it differently because you worked with like the federal government. So you're thinking about it more through like a policy perspective. Are those things that you learned about in like your ag program that they're talking about the system of how the government works with farmers?
Yeah. I mean, I worked as a technical assistance provider for many years, you know, working with USDA. And of course, the goal of that agency was to stop soil erosion and help keep the water clean and show farmers that being in a way that you protect the land, you're not counter to good production. You can increase your yields while protecting the soil. And farmers take a bad rep. And there's, like in any profession or business, there's a lot of bad people out there, bad actors.
Sure.
But, you know, farmers learn pretty quick if this farm has been passed down multiple generations. That land's been taken care of because if you don't take care of land, it erodes down to the point that it will not produce.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got parts of the country, parts of the world that the land is not arable anymore. Back to the stewardship thing, USDA had a thing. Well, it wasn't USDA, it was a partner, a hand-in-glove nonprofit, the Soil Conservation Districts. There was a thing every year called Soil Stewardship Week, and we could get materials that we would take to churches and where basically sermon plans were, you know, using biblical things to kind of teach how we take care of and are stewards. And I don't know when I ran across this verse, but Genesis 2:15 says where Adam was placed in the garden to tend and keep it.
Yeah.
And I see tend and keep it as kind of my marching orders to a degree. I mean, because tending and keeping means that it's going to be there when I'm no longer able, but my children or grandchildren are there. So, you know, and there's a lot in the Bible about, you know, animal husbandry, taking care of your livestock, taking care of the land and everything. So.
Sure. And then into the New Testament, I mean, Jesus uses a lot of agricultural metaphors and talks a lot about the land. And there's, you know, lots of reasons why people say that was, you know, that they were, you know, rural people who worked the land. So he was speaking in metaphors and parables in ways that they could understand. But it's interesting how many of those things become sort of spiritual metaphors. And he talks about, you know, like you say, like keeping the land productive becomes sort of a metaphor for our spiritual lives. If we're not nourishing and taking care of things, it leads to barrenness. And so it's some of these things are kind of the connection between the physical and the spiritual. There's a lot of that, not just with our bodies, but with the earth or with creation.
Right.
I think there's a lot of interest in that, maybe growing interest in that, even in American Christianity over the last 15 or 20 years that wasn't there before. Have you seen some of that where there seems to be sort of an interest?
I have. And even if someone doesn't prescribe to the Christian faith as we do, if you look at old religions of other types, I mean, there is a care for the land that comes with that too. I mean, it's a stewardship ethic is there that's through most anything that's been around for a long time because, you know, in order to survive, we have to take care of it. And there's so many parallels to life.
Yeah. And by no means is that an exclusively Christian idea. I mean, those ideas between connecting the land and caring for the earth, obviously Native American spirituality and all sorts of world religions, because there's something profound and connected there, right? That we are kind of connected to creation in ways that sometimes we can't even articulate and in ways that are so obvious, right? Like we literally can't survive without the food that the earth produces.
Yeah. And just the calmness of being in a green space. I mean, parks are so important in an urban area, and whether you're working the land or just out in nature, it's calm.
So going back to some of your experiences with working in the conservation job where you're employed by the federal government, you've seen not only how policy has evolved and how cultural opinions change, and you've seen Republican and Democratic administrations come and go. Have you seen a big shift in terms of the way that you think that, you know, we as a society think about stewardship of the land, think about agriculture, food production, farming?
Well, like I said, I work for a conservation-based agency, not a preservation, but a conservation, which is wise use, you know, that we can, you know, use our natural resources. If we take care of them, they'll be there for us to go. Certainly, there are areas we need to kind of set aside and just let be natural. But I work for a technical assistance agency, not a regulatory agency. I would be called by landowners maybe if they had done something, they had straightened a stream or done something, and they would point them to our agency to help that landowner rectify the situation and then get out of, you know, trouble. You know, EPA or whoever is not necessarily was just trying to hit somebody with a fine. They want to get that restored. And if they can work with the landowner to get that to do that, we would work with them on that. So yeah, it's changed over time. I mean, as technology changes, we learn more and more about things. One of the things I think that's maybe more recent is the trend talking about soil health. And that's, you know, not just, well, okay, here's the land. This is a bag of fertilizer you need to grow the crop, but working by using other plantings to increase the tilth, the organic matter of the soil. And so I think that has been probably one of the biggest things out there. I don't want to get into the whole thing about, you know, farm chemicals and stuff like that, because that's really not my area of expertise. There's a lot of controversy about that.
Sure.
You know, and there's a lot of misinformation probably from both sides. But as a whole, you know, landowners were the first conservationists, you know, or farmers, because they knew pretty quickly that if they didn't take care of that land, it wasn't going to feed their family. It wasn't going to create any income. It wasn't going to be there for them if they didn't take care of it.
Yeah. So when you first came to this part of the state, you said you moved here in 88 and you had that position with Sullivan County.
Yep.
It was then that you began working on the Appalachian RC&D like idea, or a few years after that?
It was a few years after that. I moved here in 88 and started working on that in 93. And it wasn't, I mean, this was a program that was already out there. I didn't invent anything.
Yeah.
But it was in certain counties, and I was hearing what was going on and the kind of things that the people in that job were getting to do different places. And the agency sent out a plan that, you know, they wanted to try to get it all the way across the state. And the third in line was Northeast Tennessee, the six counties that I worked in.
Okay.
And I thought, I started talking with some community leaders, a county executive at the time, and hey, can we do what they're doing there? And I said, well, are you asking for assistance? He said, well, yeah, I guess I am. So I went to my boss and said, hey, I've had this request. And it was a legitimate request. I mean, I didn't prompt him to do that or whatever.
Yeah.
And because one of the big issues then was the Solid Waste Act, I think, of 1985 or 1986 or something like that. But communities were dealing with a lot of stuff with that, having to try to meet certain goals and recycling. And so that was kind of where we sort of started to a degree with some of that. Then I was assigned to work with the counties to develop that application and wrote this long application that was submitted to the Secretary of Agriculture. And between that and local and, you know, federal political leaders, you know, pushing for it, we did get it authorized. And then I was very blessed to get hired in that job. So my job changed from working in this one county to working with six counties. And, you know, basically we kind of developed a plan of needs, and, you know, water quality was certainly around that, you know, support for local business and solid waste, dealing with recycling and things like that. And, and just community services, whether it be economic development. You know, one of the first things we kind of did the first household hazardous waste collections in this area where people could, you know, bring chemicals in. And one of the things that really kind of struck me with that was when we first started talking about it, a farmer came to me in Sullivan County and somebody had poured a bunch of paint out in the field, out through the backyard. His farm bordered a neighborhood, and somebody dumped a bunch of paint just over the fence. Well, he had several heifers, young female cows that ate it. Several of them died. It was very sad that they had to die that way, but he lost, you know, economic, you know, revenue too. So that was one of our early projects.
So what is our region like now in terms of the number of farmers, the type of farming that's being done compared to what was going on when you first came here in the 80s and 90s?
I guess one of the two big things is tobacco and dairy farming. There used to be a lot of dairy farms in the area. You know, Sullivan County, for example, probably had 15 or 20 dairies when I moved here. There may be just two, one in Piney Flats and one in Bristol. There may be another one, but I know that those two are here. And I'm proud to say I kind of helped them with some of their animal waste issues and still see those guys from time to time. So those farms have gone away. Tobacco, which has its, I don't want to get into the whole thing about tobacco, but that was a big part of, you know, farming here. A lot of people had very small patches. It was a thing that a family would work on, and it was their money that they paid their taxes with, or it was Christmas, you know, money or what it kind of got them through the winter. And they could do that with all the family. They didn't have to hire any labor. So there's very few tobacco farmers, very few dairy farmers now. What is probably stronger now is that livestock, beef cattle, is a big, big part of that. And for a few reasons. One, our land is not suited to raise crops, whether it be produce crops or corn or whatever. It's steep. The soil is thin. And, you know, a grazing animal is really the most intensive thing you can do for that land, unless you just want to let it grow up, but to kind of keep that land productive. You know, grazing cattle is the most intensive and best thing you can do with the land. So the biggest part of agriculture in Northeast Tennessee is cattle. They're all over the place, and people think, well, what few cows, what do they do? Well, these cows, you know, get fed to a certain weight here, and then they'll usually go to a feedlot somewhere in the Midwest, and then, you know, beefed up, and then they end up, you know, in the table, the food that's on your table in the grocery store or in the restaurant or whatever.
Yeah.
Something that's changing, and some of it's COVID related and some of it was already here, is that the demand for and the desire for local grass-fed beef, or beef that's maybe not raised so intensively, because of the difficulty of getting meat after COVID hit. You know, the local people were trying to get their meat locally processed, but you can't just instantly increase that. So that's been a challenge. And, you know, so there's a few meat processors around here, and those folks, where it used to be you'd say, hey, I want to bring in a cow, it'd be a month. Those folks are still a year out because of that demand for local beef has really increased. And that's great for our local farmers. The more local your food is, the better it is in many, many ways. The increase in the switch from traditional row crops to produce has become a big, big thing. I mean, you know, a local store, Food City and Ingles both, they really want to try to have that local food on the shelf there, because there's a big demand for that. I don't know when it was, I was thinking about it coming over here, but a friend, Tony DeLucia, gave me a magazine, I think it was Time Magazine, and it had a picture of an apple on it, and it said, is local the new organic? And not to slight organic farming, but it made a very compelling argument that if you're trying to be a better steward of the planet, that buying local might be better than buying something organic from California or out of the country because of the carbon footprint that it does. And I would go even further, when you buy that local product, it hasn't been shipped all the way, but it's also very strongly committing or contributing to our local economy. You know, that farmer, they're going to have to buy a new truck. So that's contributing to a lot of ways they're using their local utilities and things like that. And you can, you know, you can do pretty well off a small acreage, you know, that way. That's been a resurgence, I think, of the younger farmers. A lot of them are attracted to that. You go to the farmer's market around here now, Johnson City, Kingsport, or whatever. Now, compared to, say, 20 years ago, there's still a lot of your traditional, what you think of as the old farmer in overalls. But there's an awful lot of young folks there, too. Boy, that's exciting to me.
Yeah.
Is to see that you've got folks in there maybe doing things different than what their grandfather did. But maybe they're the first generation on a piece of land. Maybe they're the sixth generation on a piece of land. But they found a way that they can still farm and take care of that land and give their family that lifestyle, and then provide you and me with, you know, locally grown produce that you're getting to look the person in the eye that's raised it. You know, they're not going to try to pull anything on it because they want you to come back the next week. So I feel very good about our food supply when you buy it local like that.
Yeah. And we touched on a lot of these kind of topics in the previous episode in my conversation with Kathleen Terry Baker about food as an ethical, you know, sort of consideration, and making those kind of judgment calls, like to buy organic versus to buy local. And how do you put a, you know, a preference on which one's more important? And there's maybe certain pros to eating, you know, knowing that something's organic, certified organic, knowing that, you know, certain pesticides or things weren't put in the soil. But if it traveled from South America, the fuel that it, you know, so there's pros and cons to different approaches. But it seems like the more local you can get, the relational aspect of knowing your farmer. And that's something that, even since we've been back here in Northeast Tennessee, it has been a decade, but when we would go to the Johnson City farmers market, a lot of them seemed to be farmers that were going to South Carolina and buying products and then coming back up here and reselling it. And there wasn't a lot of things that were labeled, whether it was organic or not, or whether it was local or not. And I've been really pleased to see that that's been something that's sort of a consumer expectation. We were saying that to the people that ran the farmers market, but I think we're not alone. More people have been saying, hey, we want to be informed consumers. Please just tell us, you know, is this local or not? The people selling need to have things labeled. And I think that's just a transparency thing, so that people can make the decisions that they are interested in making. And obviously it's great to see that kind of stuff also, like you said, happening in Food City and Ingalls and other places where you can make more informed choices because you know, okay, this is a local apple versus this is an organic apple versus just the cheapest apple.
Right, right. You know, talking about the farmers markets, in the job that I had with the RCND with USDA, I had the opportunity to sort of consult with a lot of the farmers markets as they were kind of doing some transitioning, you know, the last 10 to 20 years. And that would always be the first thing I said, is everything local? Well, no, we've got this because, well, there's nobody. Nobody's going to be growing local bananas. Well, I don't think you should expect to get bananas at the farmer's market. I was talking with a former county mayor in Unicoi County, and there was a guy that was setting up in front of some businesses there, bringing in produce from whatever, and he said, well, I don't know that we really need to increase the farmer's market. We got this. And I said, so is that guy local? And he said, well, no, he's coming from, you know, wherever. I said, so it's not grown here. And he said, no. I said, does he collect taxes for that that go into the sales tax for the county? He said, well, no, I don't think so. And I said, so he's not, all the money that he gets goes from outside this area. He doesn't pay any taxes. And, you know, a few different things. I said, now, how is this benefiting the people in Unicoi County? I'd rather they go to the grocery store or the new Walmart there. At least it's contributing to your tax base and your labor.
Right.
I'm a big local advocate. One of the programs we did, we had a website for many years called localgoods.org, and it was a compendium of all the different things, food, clothing, anything we could find that was kind of grown or made in this region. And that was a great experience to learn about that and, you know, to learn the history of Pointer Brand Overalls. They're a business that's been in the same family for over 100 years there in Bristol and, you know, still doing that, making a product that's known all over the country and even other parts of the world.
Yeah, the intersections, right, between, you know, community and the economy and the land and stewardship, you know, so the more informed we are, the more intentional we can be. That intentionality, being ethical in a way in the world today, regardless of the sphere you're talking about, but certainly when it comes to eating and what you put in your body, it's not just going to happen by just kind of like not thinking about it. It takes intentionality.
Right. You know, the local thing was a very big thing. We tried to put it into every project that we did through the RCND Council because we felt, you know, we were getting federal funds at that time up until 2011, but we were here to serve Carter, Green, Johnson, Sullivan, Unicoi, and Washington counties in Northeast Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And if we were going to buy a bottle of water, I would try to buy it from the company that bottles out there in the industrial park in Johnson City. And I would use that when I would talk to a lot of groups, say, here's two bottles of water. Here's DeSante or whatever. And here's the local one. And so, well, let's look at these two things. Nutritionally, they're the same. They're both going to cost you about a dollar, not much difference. But this one here, there's a landowner that got paid maybe pennies per thousand gallon over in Unicoi County for selling this water and keeping his spring clean. And there was a truck driver that got paid locally to haul that to the plant. And then there's employees there and everything. And then, so that dollar that you spent, what did it do for the community?
Yeah.
So if we were going to do something like, if we wanted to give coffee cups at an event, I would try to find a local potter that would work with us on price and make something, maybe not the fanciest art, but still not something from China.
Right.
So we tried to make every project we did and still do that today as much as we can make it. If it's an arts project, it's also an economic development project.
Tell us more about Appalachian RCND. So once, I mean, it was a government program and you were in that role. Tell us more about, I mean, anything else you want to tell us about that season?
A couple of projects, very most proud of, the quilt trail. You know, I got to go out and find these barns and these quilts family had and hear the stories and get them painted by local artists or grade schools or high schools or whatever. Some of the most fun I've ever had and got paid to do it. Couldn't believe it. And maybe through the quilt trail, they found that people were coming to their farm and that they could maybe change the way they farm there. And they're doing something you can buy there, experience there. And that farm is still a family farm because that started bringing people to their site. And if we kind of help that farm when it passes from one generation to the other and it doesn't get a sign up and get chopped up into lots, and we were a part of making sure that farm goes another generation, I think that's huge. In that same light, a project that we started and are still very involved in today was working with the Land Trust for Tennessee, which helps people with a permanent conservation easement. People can take their land, they still own it, they can still pass it on, sell it or whatever, but they put a permanent restriction on that land so that it can only be developed to whatever they say, maybe one other house, or maybe the kids can build a house on the property, but it will always stay farmland. Mm. And, you know, that's some of the most enduring. I mean, those, as long as our society kind of functions like it does, those farms, those thousands of acres that will always be farmed, you know, that happened because we kind of got a partnership started with the Land Trust for Tennessee and are still working with landowners. I do that kind of as a volunteer or as a board member now.
I want to hear more about this season, like what it is now as an organization.
Sure. Well, yeah. Kind of the transition there was a dark time. I mean, I was basically told one day to leave that office and go to another USD office. I no longer had that job.
Hmm.
And I was separated from something that I truly loved and basically not even be involved with it. I sort of kind of had to on the side because we had council employees or AmeriCorps members that were working there that didn't have anybody to supervise. So I sort of had to do that on the sly, but I was not affiliated with the organization hardly at all for a year or so. Mm-hmm. But then I was asked to kind of come back on the board, and I thought, well, you know, I kind of need to be careful about that, not from a job point of view, because I wasn't in that job. I was working for the bank, but I ended up back on the board. And then I'm not sure, maybe 3 years ago or whatever, was elected as accepted the position of chairman. So I'm not so much hands-on, but I still get to be involved and see this yep. organization that I helped get started. You know, the field school program, which is a beginning farmer training, started, I forget how many years ago, but there's, you know, a few hundred people that have been through that, some very young, some older, that want to learn about farming and didn't grow up that way. And they get to spend, we have kind of two different sessions with it. One is sort of a winter business intensive, which is taking members or people signing up for it right now. And the other one is where you're getting to go and out to tour farms and kind of learn about an operation that maybe relates to fruit and produce or sheep or cattle or whatever that may be, beekeeping. We had to take all of our classes online and do Zoom and whatnot this time. The one we did on beekeeping, it just exploded. We had to go to multiple formats, and a few hundred people from all over the country signed up for that.
That's
so
cool.
I think we're making some real progress reaching people there. Another thing, we're talking about food and talking about access to food and, you know, food insecurity. You know, farmers markets can sometimes be a little pricey. You know, it's kind of in a certain location, you got to get to it there. So we've done some programs where we had some grants, some farmers market, you know, bucks or tokens. So basically, you know, they spend is $2 for those. We try to get those to people that are families that are hungry and in need of a healthier diet, because cheaper food is not healthy food for the most part. It's very highly processed, rich in sugar, you know, starch, fat, and it's not the best thing for people. So we've done a program a few years. We're trying to get more funding for it. But you go to some of the farmers markets, and if you and your family will walk to a certain point and walk a mile and come back, you'll get a token where you can buy something in the farmer's market. So basically encouraging some healthy, low intensive exercise. And then you can use that to buy fresh, local, healthy food.
But then you would turn in that token to the vendor at the farmer's market, and then they would get reimbursed by the grant or whatever.
Yeah. And we've been working, trying to get more funds with that. We've had some discussions with Ballot and others. And of course, grants are kind of wonky right now in some ways. Some are going fine. Some are not going so well. So, you know, that creates challenges for a lot of nonprofits. I guess one of the things when this first happened, we had a board meeting and we were kind of talking with the staff and we were hearing about where people were having trouble, you know, getting food, but also farmers markets weren't necessarily free to open at first. But they were starting to have produce. So you had multiple challenges. People couldn't get the local food. Farmers had been started early in the spring or over the winter growing some things, and now they couldn't sell it. So it was jeopardizing them economically. So we worked to develop some ways for people to kind of order through things. And so the staff really kind of changed their direction to work to try to connect people that were growing local food with people who were wanting to buy that. But their marketing link where they would normally meet face-to-face at the farmer's market was taken away for a while. Now farmers markets are pretty much operating, hopefully social distancing and masks and things like that, as you see.
Right.
But, you know, that was how we kind of had to sort of change our direction a little bit because we weren't going to be doing the walking program and whatnot. So, you know, working to be adaptable, you know, I think that's what any good nonprofit, you know, I mean, some nonprofits may have, this is what we do every year, day in, day out. you know, I guess kind of a focus of ours has been trying to meet unmet needs in the community.
So how long, it seemed like there was a year, like after the organization lost its federal funding, then it pivoted to becoming a nonprofit. But if I understood you right, you were not involved in that actual process because you changed to a different job, or were you involved in the process of forming the nonprofit?
The nonprofit was already there because I wrote the application for the, you know, back earlier, and it's always been a nonprofit. I mean, it was sort of a quasi, it got technical assistance from the federal government. Okay. So yeah, it was a nonprofit. We've been getting grants and things all along. And when we lost our federal funding, we kind of shifted a time or two space-wise. We weren't destitute. We had funds and things like that. You know, we had some AmeriCorps employees. Our first executive director, we actually hired her first as a as an AmeriCorps, Emily Bidgood.
Yeah.
And so she was an AmeriCorps member. And when her term ended, we realized we needed to kind of keep going. And we made sure we had the ability. So we hired her as our first executive director. And she served very well, moved us to a different level there where we were functioning purely as a nonprofit for some time. And her husband, Lee, had a chance to go to the Czech Republic with his job with the university. And and so she and I talked about what we might do. And we both had come upon the same name, Susan McKinney, who had been through our field school program. Mm-hmm. And we plotted to snare her, and we did. And she's doing a great job working with her other employees. Okay. One of the things that we're doing new this year, but we are now a host site for the Tennessee AmeriCorps program. So you'll start seeing some things. We're working with One Acre Cafe. We're placing a member with them, and they're advertising, looking for somebody who wants to work with them to learn about food insecurity and help them with their mission. So, you know, you'll get about $14,000 in sort of a living stipend. And then if you successfully complete it, you'll get $6,000 that can either be used to pay off qualified student loans or use that to further your education.
Yeah. And One Acre is a really cool, it's basically a pay what you can afford restaurant in an area that's accessible for a lot of folks who may be homeless or have food insecurity issues. So you can come in and choose to pay, you know, there's a suggested donation price for, you know, a certain meal, whether it's a small plate or a medium plate or a plate.
A large plate, yeah.
As the person eating at the restaurant, you can choose to pay more and pay it forward to help cover somebody else's meal. Or if you're a person that can't afford to pay that much, basically a pay what you can afford model, which again goes back to the idea that like we all deserve to eat.
Right.
It's a human right to be able to eat. So we need to find creative ways to make sure that regardless of whether we're employed or not, that we have the ability to eat.
Right.
So they're a cool organization for sure. I'm glad to know you guys are doing some stuff with them.
Yeah. They're a great organization. I've eaten there several times.
But we'll definitely link to their website or their Facebook page in the show notes and a variety of the other, you know, links of different groups and organizations we've referred to. My family participated in the Build It Up program a couple years ago. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That is a program that kind of came to us with an employee that had kind of helped start that before she came to us. Lexi Close had already was working in that program when we hired her, and we like what she was doing with that. So it sort of came under the umbrella, but it's to work with people, you know, in areas where you wouldn't have the ability maybe to garden or anything. Maybe you do, but you just don't have that kind of knowledge. So really it's kind of a basic how-to gardening where you get access to the technical assistance, you know, maybe to some seeds, to some tools that you may not have and everything. And to kind of, you know, get those families where they learn that it's, I mean, it's not rocket science to learn how to raise a little food, and you don't have to have a half acre. You know, you can do that. So they're working, you know, with folks in various ways with that. So Lexi's done a great job, you know, with that. What was your, I'm asking you a question. Tell me about your experience with that.
Sure. Well, I mean, we had our own garden in our backyard, but like you said, like sometimes your soil isn't conducive to yielding good produce. And so we had a garden, but had just had really, you know, clay in our soil and had not produced a lot. So one of the biggest assets was having somebody that kind of knew more come in and say, well, let's test your soil. And then as a part of the grant, they're basically like giving you the supplements, like, well, you're low on nitrate, so here's a bag of this and you need to add more of that. So it's basically just helping people who want to learn more or do more. And it takes a lot of time to research that and know how to do it. And those can be obstacles to people. So the Build It Up program for us was like really helpful because it allowed some people to come alongside us who had expertise and just removed some of those obstacles so that we could do something that we had already been trying to do, but just do it more effectively.
Yeah. 50 years ago, so many more people grew up on a farm or still live. We're just a generation away from that. And it was second nature to them to know how to do that.
Yeah.
As we get further along, people that have, you know, that grew up in an inner city, maybe have moved here, families grew up in large apartment buildings. They never had the opportunity to do that also, you know, where to start. So I think it's very empowering if you help people where they know that they can grow some of their own food. I've heard a lot of neat stories where kids that wouldn't eat vegetables, but if they got a chance to grow some, they were willing to try that.
Yeah. Talk about food insecurity and food access. I mean, so also teaching the next generation of people where the food comes from. Tomatoes don't grow in the grocery store shelf. What does a tomato plant look like? And how do you know when it's ripe and when to pick it? And, you know, or carrots or, you know, whatever. So helping, you know, the next generation of people understand how food is grown, the process that it takes to all the hours and the labor and how intensive it is. Learning some of those skills are invaluable. One other question I wanted to ask, because something I saw on your guys' website, this was from last summer, but about a wildfire prevention grant that you guys got.
Yes, and we've been getting that for several years, and we partnered starting early on with the Forest Service, which is a USDA program. And at that, you know, years ago, they had money to kind of work in community development in some ways, but they needed a local nonprofit partner. And we found we had a very good fit. That is working with communities, and it provides funding. It comes from the federal government through the state to us. And then we work with local communities, whether they be in Gatlinburg or in Johnson County or Cock County or even kind of outside our area, to help people who kind of live in what you would call the wildland fringe. If you're right close to the forest, people want to live next to the forest, but you put yourself at risk. And so that's grant money to help those communities kind of help prepare to make their homes a little bit safer. With that, I want to, if I could, introduce the rest of our staff that does a great job. Of course, I mentioned Susan McKinney. She's our executive director, kind of rides herd over everything, works on a lot of grants. She's got a good broad experience and really helps us out and is helping us to move forward. We've got two project directors. One's Lexi Close, and she oversees Build It Up along with our field school, working with beginning farmers. So she does a great job with that. She's written some very good grants, got her largest one recently. Right. And then Rachel Wheeler oversees our New AmeriCorps program and our farmers market marketing. Our marketing director is Kayla Tucker. She does a great job, you know, helping us promote things. We won two awards at the I guess it's the Pinnacle Awards, which is for tourism. We're not a tourism organization, but we won two of those awards earlier this summer for some of our programs promoting farmers market and a video about our farmers market tours.
Awesome.
And then Rosie McVeigh is our AmeriCorps member, and she's kind of a all around helping us with a lot of different things. So kind of our dream is to somehow end up on a little farm somewhere kind of close to Johnson City so that we can have our office space there and, you know, have people out, whether it be school groups or adults, and doing some training and things like that, and really can kind of take that Build It Prep program even further, and maybe even possibly where we could have a little community garden out there. If you don't have a place to raise anything, you could do that, or a place be like sort of an incubator, something we were supposed to have had, a fundraiser dinner of local food called Appalachian Fusion. Have a local chef, and we source it locally as much as we can. You know, get local meat, produce. We had it at the Kingsport Farmers Market Pavilion last year. Great event. We had a silent auction and everything. So you know, that's a kind of our major fundraiser for the year, that, you know, outside of our grants. And so we're kind of looking at a way maybe we can kind of do a virtual thing with that. But I know many nonprofits are facing challenges as far as, you know, kind of how they operate.
We'll hope that maybe the podcast gets, you know, maybe somebody wants to donate you their farm and you can get that new site. I'm not going to make any big promises like that, but maybe you'll get some new donors that'll help with, you know, kind of offsetting some of the fundraising losses of not being able to do your event this year too.
And of course, you get information about all our programs on our website, arcd.org.
Great. Great. Yeah. And one thing I like to ask people, anything that you would recommend people read, or any books or, you know, writings that are influential or that, you know, have been impactful for you?
This is I'm promoting, I guess, a TV show. It's on public TV. It's on different hours now, but it's called A Chef's Life.
Okay.
And it's about a restaurant in North Carolina, a girl that grew up in Western, or Eastern North Carolina on a big hog farm, moved away to New York, became a chef, and said she would never come back. Her parents told her that they would build a restaurant for her and her husband if they would put it in Kinston, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And what I like what she does, and she's got another show now too, but it would be whatever this week is at this restaurant, it's about collard greens. And she would go out to the farm.
Yeah.
And you meet the people and kind of learn about the history and culture of that. And then they bring it back and they'll a lot of times maybe make a new modern version of that. But you kind of get a little vignette every week where she's going back to somebody and somebody's teaching her to cook some traditional thing. And it reminds me of so many people from my childhood in, you know, rural Tennessee, a chef's life.
Okay, cool. We'll definitely link to that, as well as, you know, One Acre Cafe, the Appalachian RC&D website, and then some of the other resources that we've mentioned throughout the conversation. So
right, yeah, maybe even kind of a link to that AmeriCorps thing in particular. We're looking for organizations that are involved in food in some way or another that may want to be a host site, and also if somebody is looking to land a one-year kind of position where they would really get to AmeriCorps is a great program.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the AmeriCorps is sort of VISTA programs, things like that are really, really powerful programs and really helpful to nonprofits, giving them manpower that is a lot of times desperately needed. So.
Yes, yeah, good deal. Thanks, Aaron.
Well, thanks for taking the time to listen in to the podcast. Thank you again to Roy for his leadership of his organization and all the ways that he's been engaged for a long time, helping farmers, helping individuals think about the land and care for the land and stewardship. I want to close. Well, first, there's a variety of links that I really would love you to check out in the show notes. We talked about Roy and I both being a part of F3. And I'm going to link to F3 of Northeast Tennessee's website. I will link to the church that Roy is a member of, that's Colonial Heights Baptist Church, and a link to the passage that Roy quoted, Genesis 2:15. I will also link to the Facebook page for the Johnson City Farmers Market, the website for the Kingsport Farmers Market, and then the Appalachian RC&D website, One Acre Cafe, a couple other links, the AmeriCorps program, we will link directly to that, and the PBS show that Roy mentioned, A Chef's Life. We will also link to the Land Trust for Tennessee, Pointer Brand Jeans, which are jeans made by the L.C. King Manufacturing Company based in Bristol, a local business that Roy talked about. And then finally, a book that Roy was trying to think of the title of but couldn't come up with during the interview but wanted me to mention and include. It's called A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold.
Finally, there'll be a link to Daniel Cooper's music that you've been hearing throughout the episode, and that will be our closing music that you hear as the episode comes to a close. But the final link that I'm going to include is to a podcast of some friends of mine. The podcast is called The Membership. The Membership focuses on the writings and works of Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry is a Kentucky farmer and a writer, a thinker, and an activist who long has been an advocate for challenging the way that we approach food production and caring for the land, advocating that we need to be moving away from a mass production model and instead more towards a community-focused model. And The Membership's a great podcast. In one of the episodes of the podcast, and shout out to my friends Jason Hardy and Tim Wassum, who are co-hosts of that podcast, along with John Pattison, an author who lives in Oregon. In one of their episodes, they talked about how Wendell Berry has been advocating for policy change in the United States as it relates to agriculture. And he's been advocating in particular for the passage of a 50-year farm bill. So I don't want to read to you the article from Berry, you know, where he's talking about the farm bill and how he thinks from a policy perspective, we need to like come back to our roots or come back to our senses. You can go and read that yourself. But I want to point you to that as a resource to say that there are people out here who are saying, like, I think we've kind of lost our way and our priorities maybe have become skewed from what they need to be. But instead, I want to close with a poem that Wendell Berry wrote on hope.
And I think sometimes this podcast can be very, boy, here are the problems and how do we solve those problems? And so I think it's important to end on a note of talking about hope.
It is hard to have hope. It is harder as you grow old. For hope must not depend on feeling good. And there is the dream of loneliness at absolute midnight. You also have withdrawn belief in the present reality of the future, which surely will surprise us. And hope is harder when it cannot come by prediction any more than by wishing. But stop dithering. The young ask the old to hope. What will you tell them? Tell them at least what you say to yourself. Because we have not made our lives to fit our places, the forests are ruined, the fields eroded, the streams polluted, the mountains overturned. Hope then to belong to your place by your own knowledge of what it is that no other place is, and by your caring for it as you care for no other place. This place that you belong to, though it is not yours, for it was from the beginning and will be to the end. Belong to your place by knowledge of the others who are your neighbors in it, the old man, sick and poor, who comes like a heron to fish in the creek, and the fish in the creek, and the heron who manlike fishes for the fish in the creek, and the birds who sing in the trees in the silence of the fishermen, and the heron, and the trees that keep the land they stand upon as we too must keep it or die. This knowledge cannot be taken from you by power or by wealth. It will stop your ears to the powerful when they ask for your faith, and to the wealthy when they ask for your land and your work. Answer with knowledge of the others who are here and how to be here with them. By this knowledge, make the sense you need to make. By it, stand in the dignity of good sense, whatever may follow. Speak to your fellow humans as your place has taught you to speak, as it has spoken to you. Speak its dialect as your old compatriots spoke it before they had heard a radio. Speak publicly what cannot be taught or learned in public. Listen privately, silently, to the voices that rise up from the pages of books and from your own heart. Be still and listen to the voices that belong to the stream banks and the trees and the open fields. There are songs and sayings that belong to this place, by which it speaks for itself and no other. Found your hope, then, on the ground under your feet. Your hope of heaven, let it rest on the ground underfoot. Be it lighted by the light that falls freely upon it after the darkness of the nights and the darkness of our ignorance and madness. Let it be lighted also by the light that is within you, which is the light of imagination. By it you see the likeness of people in other places to yourself in your place. It lights invariably the need for care toward other people, other creatures, in other places, as you would ask them for care toward your place and you. No place at last is better than the world. The world is no better than its places. Its places at last are no better than their people, while their people continue in them. When the people make dark the light within them, the world darkens. Until next time, unleash your own generosity. Brother!